5 years and then we have to do the whole city section.
We will call the last meeting of the taxation committee to order and have Emily call the roll.
Thank you, Chairman Unruh. Chairman Unruh?
Present.
Senators Beckedahl?
Here.
Cook?
Here.
Dotsenrod? Hoag?
Here.
Levine? And Triplett?
Present.
And Representatives Hedlund? Belter?
Here.
Doctor?
Here.
Proseth?
Here.
Halsted? Kading? Casper? Kelch?
Here.
Mitzkoff? Steiner?
Here.
And Strandon? And Madam Chairman, we do have a quorum.
That is good news. Thank you for everybody who came this morning. The first thing that we have on our agenda is consideration of the minutes from the June 30th, 2016 meeting. Do we have a motion for approval?
So moved. Second.
It's been moved and seconded to approve the minutes from our June 30th meeting. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign. Motion carries. Thank you. Next up, our 905 agenda item is a presentation by Legislative Council staff on a bill draft relating to an oil extraction tax credit for carbon dioxide used for enhanced oil recovery. This was a concept taken from the report that we received from IHS Energy. Excuse me, I have a cold this morning. This bill draft was considered by the Energy Development and Transmission Committee. It was something that had been considered by the North Dakota Empower Group as well. And like I said, it was just a piece of the report that we had received. The Energy Development and Transmission Committee decided not to take action on this bill in their meeting, which I attended yesterday. And that was their last meeting as well. So if we want this idea and concept to move forward into next session, we will have to pass it out of this committee. Emily will review that for us, and we can have some discussion and receive some feedback from those in the audience as well. Emily?
Thank you, Chairman Unruh. And the bill draft that you're looking at today is number 17.020601. Again, as Chairman Unruh mentioned, that this was already reviewed in the Energy Development and Transmission Committee. There aren't any changes to the bill draft you see before you today than what was presented in that other interim committee. Pretty straightforward draft as far as the purpose of the draft. Again, it provides an oil extraction tax credit for carbon dioxide used for enhanced oil recovery. The first section you see there is actually a reference to the gross production tax chapter. All of the reporting requirements for both gross production tax and oil extraction tax are all in the gross production tax chapter, so that's why you see the reporting requirements cited here. In this section, it does refer to that on any oil or gas produced or sold, the tax must be paid by the purchaser. The purchaser is authorized to deduct in making settlement with a producer or royalty owner the amount of tax paid, and the new language here is after deduction of any credit allowed in the new section of law allowing for the CO2 credit to which the producer would be entitled if paying the tax, and that must be verified by documentation provided from the producer to the purchaser. Generally, the purchaser pays the tax. The producer would be required to pay the tax in a case where the producer would store the oil or gas. I believe there are some various exceptions for inventory and carryover and that type of thing. The meat of the credit that you're looking at is in Section 3 of the bill. The only change in Section 2 is to just specify that the new tertiary recovery methods does not include water flooding or miscible natural gas injection or miscible carbon dioxide displacement. So we're essentially removing the use of enhanced oil recovery with CO2 from tertiary recovery methods in that section just by changing the definition. Looking at the actual oil extraction tax credit, notes that the producer, subject to tax, is entitled to a credit against taxes that apply to the producer's interest in oil. The credit here is $10 per ton of CO2 purchased or acquired for use in enhanced oil recovery in North Dakota. We did note the phrase purchased or acquired, so that if it's kind of a closed system where the entity that's generating the CO2 and capturing the CO2 is also injecting the CO2, there isn't a necessity to purchase it. It would just be acquired in that instance and still be available for the credit. The oil producer is required to report to the Industrial Commission the amount of CO2 that's initially injected by the producer into the oil reservoir. And the initially injected language is placed in the bill draft because a portion of the injected CO2 can be recycled and essentially re-injected into the oil reservoir for enhanced recovery. And that language just prevents there being any kind of double counting on a portion of that CO2 that's injected. The Industrial Commission is required to certify to the tax commissioner the amount by each oil producer of the CO2 initially injected into an oil reservoir for purposes of enhanced recovery. And this gives the tax commissioner some verification and auditing role so they can verify that that CO2 is actually being injected for enhanced oil recovery. An oil producer that wants to claim the credit must claim the credit in a format prescribed by the tax commissioner. So that's been pretty well open for the tax commissioner to prescribe the specifics of how they would want that filed. The purchaser of oil can deduct from any tax due the credit under this section to which the producer would be entitled to paying a tax. The return filed by the purchaser for the taxable period must include documentation, again in the format prescribed by the tax commissioner, verifying the amount of the producer's credit deducted if that credit isn't, in a sense, being passed through to when the purchaser is claiming it rather than when the producer would be filing and paying the tax. The effective date for taxable events after June 30th, 2017, standard effective date that we usually see in our tax committee bills. So that's a brief summary of the credit. I'd be happy to try and answer any questions you may have. And I know we also have some representatives from the tax department that deal with oil and gas. If you have any more specific questions, I might have to defer to them on a few. Thank you.
Any questions for Emily from the committee? Representative Frosa.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Just to clarify this somewhat, I guess, the tax credit would be applied to the gross production and the extraction tax, the credit to those two taxes, or would be applied to the income tax the oil companies would be required to pay, or just would this tax be applied?
The tax would be applied to the gross production and oil extraction tax. Those are filed essentially in the same report as far as I'm aware, so parsing those out, there might be some administrative difficulties there.
Continue.
Thank you. So then if this carbon dioxide is used to, in secondary recovery, it would be, they'd be exempt from the 5% production tax. And if it's used for enhancement, it would be subject to both taxes. If it was used for secondary recovery, like stripper wells are now, it would be exempt from the 5% production tax to start with.
Chairman Under, just to clarify, the credit applies to the oil extraction tax, but I believe just the way both of those taxes are reported to track that to the dollars is kind of a difficult to tie it specifically to certain revenue streams. And I might need the tax department to clarify more on how those reports are filed, because it was explained to me, but I'm not the administrator of that, so they might need to clarify that point a little bit there.
And we do have the tax department scheduled to discuss this with the committee a little bit later on in the agenda, continue. Unless they're here.
May I continue?
I don't think they are. Yes, continue, Representative Frosa.
Another thing that bothers me are concerns me, I guess, is just how much is $10 a ton? I mean, it's completely new, and I don't understand just exactly how much that would amount to. How many ton could they dispose of, and how much of a tax break could they possibly get, like, on, say, a production of a well that was producing 300-400 barrels a day or something like that? I don't know. Put it into some kind of a comparison so you could understand it.
Chairman, committee members, there is no cap currently placed on this bill draft for a certain amount of the credit that would be awarded. And again, just as a reminder, the report provided by IHS Energy did note that the technology for this type of recovery is a ways off, so I don't know what the immediate fiscal impact would be, at least for this upcoming biennium. And a fiscal note wasn't prepared in relation to this bill draft.
Senator Cook.
Madam Chair, I think the problem that we're trying to solve with this bill is our challenges that are presented to the power generation industry as far as meeting the clean coal standards that we're going to be forced to meet. And that's to take out the CO2, of course, and then to find a market for it. Do you think it would be wise if this bill was to move forward that we made it clear that the credit would only be available on North Dakota produced CO2?
That's a good question, Senator Cook, and something that I've been kicking around. Obviously, that's part of the problem that we're trying to solve, that and increase production in the Bakken with less infrastructure. I think we may run into some interstate commerce issues if we try to specify that the CO2 has to come from here, but there could be a way to work around that.
I'm sure there is,
and I'm continuing those efforts to try and figure out exactly how we could do that and make it fair and incentivize what we're meaning to incentivize. I am not convinced that this bill draft does what we're intending to do.
I think there's a lot of unanswered questions yet, and as far as we know, we have to do something, I think, but as far as what's the right thing to do, I think there's a lot of unanswered questions yet.
Thank you, Senator Cook. I tend to agree with you. Any other comments from committee members? Senator Triplett.
Madam Chairman, my question is either for Ms. Thompson or yourself or for anyone else who serves on both this committee and the Energy Transmission Committee. I guess I would just like a sense or a flavor of the concerns that were expressed in that committee that caused them not to pass, not to move the bill forward. And you know, maybe Senator Cook has just brought one of them up, but could you just elaborate for us on sort of a summary of the discussion from 2 days ago or yesterday, whenever it happened?
Oh, yes. Thank you, Senator Triplett. So Energy Development and Transmission met a little over a month ago when they originally considered this bill draft. And the discussion in the committee was very positive. I think from their perspective, since it was a tax bill, there were a lot of pieces of it that they didn't quite fully wrap their heads around. They hadn't done all the studies that we had done in this committee. So I think they were very supportive of the concept, but maybe not necessarily specifically the way this bill was drafted. When it was brought up on Monday in committee, Senator Wardner just said that they would not be taking any action on it and leaving it on the table. There wasn't a lot of committee discussion on the specific bill draft. So he said he would leave it to the taxation committee, since we had done all of the studies and research on the topic, to make a decision on whether or not this specific concept should move forward into session. And if I missed anything, Emily, please fill the gaps. But Senator Hoag.
Madam Chair, did the committee come up with any fiscal note, or did they conclude that since the technology is so far out there, a fiscal note would be too speculative, or what's the status of that?
Thank you, Senator Hoag. We have discussed with the tax department what the fiscal note may look like for something like this, and I think immediately in the next biennium we can all agree that it would be relatively zero. But moving forward, it's kind of hard to project what that could be. I think Emily might have some idea of what the numbers could be, you know, based on it, you'd have to assume a certain amount of carbon dioxide being captured and injected, but it was too difficult to try and project anything. And certainly, I think for this biennium, it would be projected to be zero from my discussions with the tax department.
Madam Chair.
Representative Froseth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wonder if there's any past history of the state ever incentivizing some other commodity from some other state with North Dakota for the credit towards North Dakota taxes.
That's a very good question, Representative Froseth. I certainly don't have the answer, but we can definitely do some more research.
Yeah, I'd be happy to look for some information on that, Chairman.
Senator Cook.
Madam President, or Chairman, I'm sorry.
You can call me Madam President if you'd like.
Just don't call you late at night. Huh? I was fortunate to be one of six legislators that got to take a trip down to Houston, an energy-sponsored trip. There's leadership and the two tax committee chairmen. There we toured three sites. The first site was a alum cycle power plant being built. The second site was a Denbury enhanced oil recovery field. And then the third site was an existing coal-fired power plant burning Wyoming coal that was being retrofitted at the back end of the plant to take the CO2 out of the stack. None of them were completed yet. The third place is getting awful close to being completed. But what I've seen there is, number one, it appears that the technology exists to remove 100% of the CO2. The technology exists to put it in an oil field for enhanced oil recovery. It's huge. It costs a lot of money. And it's the technology does not exist yet for directional drill wells in the Bakken. But we came away from that with no answers, I think, as far as what we should do going forward. But a challenge to whatever we do, we should do it right. The other thing I came away from there is the importance that I think they demonstrated of, to make this work, you need to incentivize the producers of the CO2, not the users of the CO2. You need to have a carrot out there to entice the people who produce the CO2, the power plants, to invest the tremendous amount of money they're going to have to invest to take the CO2 out of it. And I don't know what we'll do to accomplish that at this point, but I think we're moving in the right direction, but I think we've got a lot of work to do yet. That's the only point I want to make.
Thank you, Senator Cook. I agree wholeheartedly. Well, it's taken me some time to come around to shifting the incentive from the back end to the front end. I think I can see the need for that here.
Well, Madam Chair, I think most of the presentation we had during this interim was focusing on the back end.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the report led us, and this is the logical solution, I think. But just taking that trip, and it was leadership and the two tax committee chairs that were on it, and it's really made the importance that we should focus on the producing end and find a policy there and then see whether we think it'll work.
Thank you, Senator Cook. And I can't speak for Representative Hedlund. He couldn't be here today. He's in the combine. But I know he went with the Texas trip and had very similar sentiments about how we should be approaching this. So any other committee discussion? Okay, and we've got all morning to discuss this a little bit further and decide what we want to do, but I think we can move on to our 9:20 agenda item, which is comments from interested persons regarding both the bill draft and the final report provided by IHS Energy to our committee study topics. And I'd be happy to receive any type of feedback on the bill draft, any additional information on the trip that was taken by some of the committee members or the final report or any of the concepts in there from IHS. So
good morning, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jason Bohrer, the President and CEO of the Lignite Energy Council. Glad to be before you this morning and just offer some brief comments on the bill draft as it is presented to you and kind of what we have learned also about the best way to go about this. First of all, we support the concept of what this committee is trying to do, and this bill draft represents a great first step, I think, toward getting a solution in place that is really a benefit for everybody involved. It's going to be a benefit for the coal industry, providing us a solution to disposing and getting rid of the CO2. I think it's going to be a win for the oil and gas industry, but I definitely think it's going to be a win for the people in North Dakota, as it extends the life of both the coal plants and the oil fields, and provides a new source of revenue as infrastructure is built out. Having said that, and after having participated in that trip down to Houston, I would say that it's worth waiting and getting this bill right rather than rushing it through. As indicated earlier, there's no fiscal note associated with this because you don't anticipate any revenue coming in the next couple of years, and certainly we don't anticipate anything being built in the next couple of years that would be able to monetize our CO2 in a way that would necessitate this type of bill. Now, having said that, you can do whatever the committee thinks is best. This is a timely issue for us, but it's not a timely issue that needs to be resolved in the next 6 months to a year. So if this committee decides to wait to pursue further action on this, we wouldn't object to that. I think there is some further thought to be into where that incentive is ultimately placed and how that is ultimately decided. But I just wanted to stand before you and offer our thoughts and thank you for this work. This is something that needs to be done, and I think there's a lot of benefits to doing it right. With that, if you have any questions, I'd be glad to take them at this moment.
Questions for Mr. Boer? Senator Triplett?
Not my question, Madam Chairman, but I think that this might be the correct person to answer Representative Frostath's earlier question about help us understand what $10 a ton means.
$10 a ton, let me address that from two, or Senator Triplett, Madam Chairman, members of the committee, let me address that a couple different ways. First one is the estimates are you get, generally speaking, about 2.5 barrels of oil per ton of CO2. There's variations in that, of course. There's going to be great variations in that, I think, as you try and extend this technology into places where it's never been done before, like the shales. But we think there's enough traditional vertical wells in North Dakota that are that could benefit from this technology that you wouldn't have to solve that geology question yet. And I think it's probably a reasonable assumption to use the 2.5 barrel per ton average in those wells. So that can give you an idea of how much oil you could get out of this as you use 3 million tons of CO2 or whatever it might be from a large coal plant. And I don't know that you'd be able to capture that 3 million tons immediately, but that's what you would be looking at. What does it mean for the economics of it from a coal perspective? $10 a ton is not enough to make the project go off the ground absent any other incentives. So we think it's a very good marginal improvement. As our members look at answering that question, do we build $800 million worth of infrastructure to capture CO2? There's a lot of things that work there. And this is probably an example of which there's going to need to be a federal element involved, and there's going to need to be a large industrial investment. And then you look and say the $10 a ton is another piece in that puzzle of bridging that gap. Because $10 a ton on its own is not enough to make the coal plant say, hey, now the economics work. You need a couple things, and one of them is some assurity that you're going to continue to have you know, high enough oil prices that it makes sense too. So $10 a ton is not enough to flip the economics on its own. It is enough to close the gap when there's a few other pieces of the puzzle that are in place.
Thank you. Representative Roseth.
Thank you, Chair. My fuzzy math says that 2.5 barrels per ton of CO2. 2.5 barrels at $50 a barrel would be about $125 worth of oil. 10% tax would be $12.50. $10 a ton credit wouldn't be much left.
Representative for the members of the committee, one way to look at it is to break it down purely by the numbers and look at that. I think what, when you're talking about the incremental production of oil, is absent this credit, where would that oil be? And it would remain in the ground. And so I think you're looking at it to say, without this credit, what do we get? And it's zero. With this credit, what do we get? Not as much as you'd get if there was no incentive. And so even if it's a little bit that's left over, that's an additional benefit to the state that wouldn't be there but for this credit. So when you're talking about incremental production of oil, look at the vertical wells in North Dakota right now. They've been there for how many years, just sitting there. The oil's not going to move out of those wells, because it hasn't, until there's a credit put in place that incentivizes somebody, a partnership, to somehow get CO2 into this state and use it to get that additional oil out of the ground.
Senator Cook.
Madam Chairman, I believe when you look at all the pieces to the puzzle, as far as the economics go, another piece of the puzzle would be increase cost for our electricity. That's, of course, a piece of the puzzle we don't want to have to rely on. If we are still faced with a mandate to remove 100% of the CO2, then it doesn't really matter about the economics. It's got to happen, and we can do all we can, and all we're doing is really trying to reduce the increase in the price that we're all going to be paying for our electricity.
Yeah. Senator Cook, Madam Chairman, members of the committee, that's the other way of looking at it, is you could almost put aside, of course, coming from the lignite industry, this isn't going to surprise you, but if the economics bear it out, that you could put aside the entire question of how much incremental oil you get. It's still worthwhile to make this investment if it's able to keep those plants operating, because you're looking at anywhere from a 20 to 50% increase in electricity rates if our coal plants are shut down, and 40 and half of them need to come offline in order to comply with the Clean Power Plan. So you start saying, what's the cost to the consumer in North Dakota if everybody's electricity bills start going up? What's the cost to the state? What's the decreased revenue that's coming in from a decrease in industrial activity? And that it kind of swamps the benefit that you get out of the increased oil. We think the increased oil, from our perspective, the increased oil revenue, even if it is not billions of dollars, it's just a plus. It's just a, you know, a cherry on top that says, hey, not only did we maintain low electricity rates, not only did we maintain the 4,000 jobs at lignite plants, but hey, we got a little extra oil out of the ground, and we made that industry a little bit more stable and less susceptible to the long-term ups and downs of that industry. So, Senator Cook, I appreciate the way of you looking at it that way, because the economics bear this project or this concept out either way you consider it, I think.
Increased regulations and increased electricity costs bogged down the economy. Senator Cook.
Just to follow up, we also got to mention, talk about sustainable electricity too. We get that from coal-fired power plants.
Yep. Representative Belter.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. A couple of questions. One was, could you repeat, you mentioned, you gave some statistics on the cost, the increase in potential cost of our utility bills. The other question that I have is, you mentioned participation by the feds in such a program. With the current executive branch's
attitude on fossil fuel. Is there any activity going on in Washington, D.C. that would help us with this type of project?
Right. Great question, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. That I'll repeat that the potential increase in rates is anywhere from 20% to 50%. That goes on from a reduction in the capacity of our coal-fired electric plants. So the low end is 20, the high end is 50. There's various studies in the middle that are predicting this. I think I just explain it pretty simply to folks and say it's well known that coal, lignite coal plants are the cheapest source of electricity. You can't remove the cheapest source of a product and not expect it's all and not have to pay more. I mean, it's basic economics that when you remove the cheapest option, all that is left is more expensive options, and some of those are drastically more expensive. Turning to the question of federal involvement in this particular administration, it's with this administration winding down, what we're hoping for is some additional budget support as Congress passes some of its final appropriation bills. Looking forward into our crystal ball into the next administration, we think that either candidate is going to be more receptive to increased research, development, and projects with the fossil industry than this current administration is. So we do see some hope in the future for a federal government that says, we want to make this happen. Let's get it done in North Dakota. We've spent quite a bit of time doing outreach to the Department of Energy in Washington, D.C., and the folks there want this to happen. And I think we've convinced them that the next place that needs to happen is North Dakota. Backing up just a little bit, even this administration has supported these types of projects in the United States. So this Department of Energy has spent some money and resources on getting fossil carbon capture sequestration projects off the ground. So this isn't the ideal administration for these projects, but they have done some things there, and we think that either of the candidates in the future is going to be yet another step up, and we think that our job is to be there ready with the plan when they get sworn in and start going forward from that point.
Okay, thank you, Jason. I don't see any other questions.
Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dale Nieswag, representing Basin Electric Power Cooperative. I guess a couple of comments that we've got. Number one, I want to commend the committee on the work. We appreciate the committee looking at this type of technology and what this can possibly do. It's critically important for the coal industry, for the utility industry that use coal and want to see a path forward for coal. Based on the bill draft that's out there and the information we learned, we think there should be some modifications to the bill as it is. There was a good amount of information that we received and a good amount of knowledge. Basin Electric was one of the utilities that tried to organize the trip, and we thought it would be good to bring legislators down there and kind of give them information. And from a utility perspective, we got just as much information and learned a whole lot more going down there, so it was a very valuable trip. We do think this needs to continue, but we don't know that it needs to happen right now. I think we've got time. We don't see technology out there in the next 2 years that would make this, that make the legislation critical this time. As the question came up on federal work, there is federal work going down. There is a section of the tax code called Q45 or 45Q, I get confused on that. And what it does provide the same type of tax credit for using CO2 to get oil out of the ground. Now they're looking, I believe it's anywhere from $10 to $30 on that portion of it. But at this time, the tax code is so unworkable, it has not been used very much. And so that's why there are two bills in Congress, I believe, one from Senator Heitkamp, one from Senator Hovind, to try and adjust that and make that more usable for us. So we do have federal work going on with that. So we're looking at a combination of industry, state, and federal to make this all go. As far as costs, and I hesitate to throw this out there, but I believe that what we're looking at from a utility side is anywhere from $50 to $70 a ton to try and put the equipment on to try and capture CO2. So that's why we're looking at getting support from industry, federal and state, to try and make this all come together. As we look at this, there's so many things that need to come together. Number one, we've got to come up with technology that allow us to capture the CO2 either off of existing plant or off of a new plant. That's number one. Number two, we've got to be able to have, I shouldn't say, it's very advantageous if we can find a way for the oil companies to use it. But at this point, they need to have some incentive to do that, because it's very expensive for them to also set up an oil field to accept CO2. So there's costs on the utility side, there's costs on the oil and gas side, and then there's got to be the price that makes it marketable for them to do that. So at this point, we're working on the technology to capture or produce a pure stream of CO2 that can be captured. We've got EERC working on how do we make this work in the oil fields. There's three things we can do with it. I mean, if you produce electricity from coal, you're going to have CO2. That's just physics. We can't do anything about that. It's what can you do with that CO2 stream? At this point, we've got three choices. We can use it in conventional wells, which we know works. Our DGC plant captures it, sends it to Canada, where it's used on an existing oil field very successfully. Same thing with success in Texas. We know that works on conventional fields. So if we can get that work, that's kind of phase number one. The other side is to sequester. We know that there are caverns in central North Dakota, in fact, underneath the Coteau coal mine, underneath Antelope Valley Station. There are places to sequester CO2. And then the brass ring is the Bakken. Is there a way to use it out there? And so we've got those types of facilities out there. At this point, we're looking at the IHS report that this committee commissioned, and they do separate Bakken EOR recovery from conventional. So what we're looking at now is trying to take that information and say, how much CO2 could we use in conventional wells in North Dakota, and then how much, you know, could we capture, and where do those numbers come together? So we're going to try and use the IHS report and EERC to come up with some numbers to make that work out. So kind of a rambling testimony, and I apologize for that, but number one, we encourage the committee to keep working on this. We think it's got a lot of promise. We think based on the information that we've learned, we can put together a better bill than what's here. We don't see the need to have a bill this session. We think maybe if we don't do anything this session, we work on it over the interim, it would be useful. We could come back together if we could work with the legislators on a better piece of legislation in 2019 and make that happen. So, like I said, I apologize for the rambling tone of my testimony, but that's kind of where we're at. So we like what you're doing and just think we can put together a better product than what we've got right now based on the information that we have.
Thank you, Mr. Nieswagen. We'll accept your rambling testimony. I think we've all learned that this is not an easy topic to get your hands wrapped around by any means this interim. So, Senator Triplett.
Madam Chair and Mr. Nieswagen, I guess I'm comfortable with your suggestion and the suggestion we've heard from others that we not move forward with this particular bill draft at this last meeting of this interim committee. I guess I'm less sure of why you would suggest we would leave it for a full 2 years rather than try to put something together. I mean, surely, you know, any of us as individuals or, you know, a group of us can sponsor legislation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you just need a little more time to analyze the information that you've learned in the recent trip to Texas and to go through the report and to see which of the two bills that our senators are bringing forward might, you know, mm-hmm. come through a lame duck Congress. It seems to me that this is a moment in time when a lot of things are kind of coming together. And, you know, I sat through the Great Plains Energy Corridor and Empower Conference yesterday and heard the same mantra that we've heard for years and years and years from both the coal and the oil industry in North Dakota, which is that regulatory certainty is incredibly important. And so, you know, if there's a chance for us to get ahead of the curve a little bit by putting something in place that then industry can rely on and use to move forward, why would we wait 2 years?
Madam Chairman, Senator Triplett, I guess I apologize. I don't, I, I didn't mean that we necessarily had to wait. I believe we can wait. If there's the desire and the chance to try and work on something and do it in this session, we're all for helping, doing what we can to help the committee come up with that, or helping the legislature come up with the bill to do that. The only reason I said that we could wait for the interim is that I don't think it definitely has to be. If we can come up with something this session, fine, that's great. If we don't, and it happens to slip till 2019, I don't see that as a make or break problem.
Thank you, Mr. Niesweg, and thank you, Senator Triplett, for your comments. You took the words out of my mouth. I think we can still certainly try to work on something, and if it comes together, that's great to provide that regulatory certainty that we're always trying to make sure that we have for our industry here in the state. So there is something there that can be relied on, but there are so many moving pieces, as we've learned through the interim. I'm not sure we can get there, but we can certainly try.
And I guess a reason, I think we're going to learn a lot. You know, the alum cycle that is being tested, which is a new technology to use coal and capture CO2 stream, that will start running in April of next year. They hope by the end of 2017 to have the information that says, yes, this technology does work on a pilot scale, and then their next step is to build a 300-megawatt plant. So by the end of 2017, we'll know whether we got the new technology. We know that Pincota Power is working on what they call Project Tundra, which is a way to capture CO2 on the back of an existing plant. We know they will have more information as 2017 goes through. So that was kind of the main reason. We'll know more as we go forward, but we appreciate the state legislature trying to put together a bill that shows that the state is supportive of this of new technology and trying to find a path forward for coal. So we do understand that it's important that the state have that signal out there that we are willing to help that, and so we're supportive of that as well.
Thank you. Senator Cook?
Madam Chairman, Dale, just so I'm certain, if the alum cycle works in Texas, that does not mean it's going to work here. Is that correct? I mean, they're burning Wyoming coal. We're burning lignite, so there still has to be some technology to make sure that the alum cycle can work on our lignite. Is that a big challenge?
Madam Chairman and Senator Cook, two things. The alum cycle burns a gas. So this alum cycle can be used with natural gas or gasified coal. But so what they want to do is what they'll do in Texas is they will determine that the technology works with natural gas. Then they want to do is they want to build a 300-megawatt plant, make sure it works on natural gas, and then they want to put in gasified coal, so to determine that it works. But you're correct. Lignite, we know, works well in the gasification process. That's one of the advantages that it has over Wyoming coal, is that when you gasify it, lignite gasifies better than Wyoming coal. Where this gets the Department of Energy excited is that, and I believe the percentage may not be correct, but I believe 60% of all the coal in the world is some form of lignite. So they see if we can find this technology and make it work with lignite coal, that it opens up a lot of doors for the worldwide use of this technology and coal and capture of CO2. And that's why we're encouraging that plant get built in North Dakota, because we have supply of natural gas. We also have the technology to gasify coal. So we said you can test out both systems in one location. And that's why we're encouraging that. And we've gotten a good reception from DOE on that. And the partners we're working with on Alum are also receptive to doing that as well.
Okay, I don't see any more questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any other interested parties wanting to provide comment to the IHS study or the bill we have in front of us? Okay, nobody else is jumping out of their chair, so we shall move on. I think we'll go to our 10:30 agenda item, which is a presentation by Legislative Council staff of a memorandum summarizing tax incentives associated with enhanced recovery of oil and gas and the fiscal impact of each incentive. Emily?
Thank you, Chairman Unruh. This memorandum is just a second version of the memo you received at the previous Taxation Committee meeting. There was a request at the prior meeting to add to this chart by adding that column you see on your right, the usage and fiscal impact of each incentive. It did receive data from the Tax Department on the first four incentives that you see on your list. First off, the oil extraction tax exemption for incremental production from secondary or tertiary recovery projects. Now, the tax department indicated that from fiscal year 2002 through fiscal year 2016, there were three qualifying secondary recovery projects, two smaller projects, the Moore North Red River Unit and the Grand Red River Unit B. And then there was also the more sizable Cedar Hills Unit Project, which produced exempt incremental oil from 2002 through 2007. The fiscal impact of this incentive, unfortunately, is not readily available, as GenTax, the computer system used up in the tax department, does not contain computerized production statistics for periods beyond the last 6 years. As you can see, the three projects noted are older than that date. So unfortunately, the fiscal impact is not provided for this incentive. The following two incentives, again, neither have been claimed. So as far as usage and fiscal impact, you won't see any results in that column. And the last incentive, the sales and use tax exemption for environmental upgrade materials used in power plants and processing plants. This incentive was claimed for seven projects from fiscal year 2008 through fiscal year 2016. The combined fiscal impact for this incentive, and that would be for all qualifying projects together, totals just shy of $26 million in state sales tax exemptions. I did provide a notation for the last three incentives on your chart that the information pertaining to the incentive is being compiled. I did receive some information from the tax department that there are some minor data inconsistencies for the coal incentives. So they are trying to iron that out and kind of get the data that we would need to reply to the fiscal impact and usage of those last three. So that's why I just noted that it is still being compiled, and I would be happy to relay any supplemental information that we receive from the tax commissioner's office and as a supplement to this memo when it is provided.
Thank you, Emily. Representative Froseth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Emily, I don't know if you know, but maybe there's someone from the tax department, but what's our policy? We're sending the CO2 from the Beulah plant to Weyburn. What is the tax policy on that? Are we paying them to take it? Are they paying us to use it? I don't think I've ever heard. I don't know what the policy is there.
I see we do have our deputy tax commissioner in the audience here this morning. And I also have my red book here, which may which may help us. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning, Madam Chairman. I believe because it would be used in enhanced recovery, it would be exempt under Dakota law. So I don't believe there's a tax implication for that. I don't believe so.
Madam Chairman.
Senator Triplett.
Mr. Morris, I could probably verify that there is a contract in place, though, right? It's between the company, the Dakota Gas, and the folks in Weyburn. They sell it. It's not like it's being given away. So maybe that would help to answer Representative Froseth's question, if you know.
Madam Chairman, Senator Triplett, I don't know the specifics of that, but somebody from the industry could probably address that.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Morissette. Mr. Nieswag? You brought back up today, I see.
Again, yeah. For the record, Dale Nieswag from Bay Sladek. I have our manager of multi-state tax here, and he can give you some more information on how that works between Dakota Gas and our tax. So I'd like to have Don Bain come and see.
Good morning. Mr. Bain.
How are you?
Fabulous.
For Dakota Gasification does in fact have a contract in place where we sell the CO2 to a company in Weyburn, Saskatchewan. So, but the sales of the CO2 is specifically exempt from sales tax. But on the flip side, when we produce the CO2, there's a CO2 capture credit that we are allowed to take a credit against our coal conversion taxes for the amount of gas that we sell. That coal conversion, that capture credit is 20%. We get a full credit for the first 20% and then 1% for every 2% that we capture beyond that. and that is taken just off of the state's portion of the coal conversion tax. So the county still gets their 15%. The Lignite Research Fund still gets that 5% of the remainder, and then the credit comes off of the state portion of the coal conversion. And there is a sunset. The sunset of that CO2 capture credit expires in 2019.
Representative Roseth.
There must be a cost for transporting that and maintaining the pipeline. Whose expense is that?
Madam Chairman, Representative Roseth, you are correct. It is all DGC has to pay for the entire cost of the operation. We also pay a property tax on that, on the pipeline that goes all into Canada. We pay it in North Dakota and we pay it in Canada. And but the entire cost of the operation and the maintenance of that pipeline is Dakota Gas's.
Okay, I don't see, oh, Senator Triplett.
Madam Chair, we may be trailing a little bit off the topic here, but
we've
to
got
follow
time.
Through. Yeah, thank you. Mr. Beam, it's my understanding too that that contract is scheduled to expire soon, is that correct? Can you tell us when the contract terminates?
Madam Chairman, Representative Triplett, or Senator Triplett, I do not know when the contract does expire. There are multiple provisions in that contract, and I do not know all the conditions to that. I do know that over the course of the time, the initial, when we had the pipeline in place, we were capturing and sending 46% of our CO2 up there. It is down to roughly 40 and even sometimes lower because of they have requirements to take Canadian CO2 production as well. So the dependence on that, on our CO2, is decreasing every year.
And it's also true, I believe, that we've heard in testimony previously on this topic that the pipeline that is in place to transport that CO2 has off ramps, as it were, built in at a variety of places that would make it relatively easy to redirect the CO2 to the oil fields of North Dakota. Is that also correct?
Madam Chairman, Senator Triplett, that is true. We have various ports along the place. We have a 14-inch line up to Tioga, and then beyond that is a 12-inch, and there are places that we put in there where we could run pipe to divert that CO2 from there.
Thank you. Senator Beckedahl has a question for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Beam, do you have any quantification to the dollar amounts of the coal conversion facilities privilege tax credit for CO2 capture and the sales tax exemption? We also talked about fiscal notes on the state side. Can you tell us can you quantify the amounts of dollars in those taxes that are being saved?
Madam Chairman, Senator Beckedahl, I can quantify that. I don't have that off the top of my head. I do know that I presented the information. I gave the information the other day to Adam, the representative for the
works for Legislative Council.
For the Legislative Council for the ED&T committee. I provided him the full information the other day. I don't know that off the top of my head, but we clearly can get that for you.
Dale?
And as a side note, when we got the CO2 tax credit, part of the legislation required a yearly update. Correct. That we provide, I'm trying to think which committee, is it might be the Energy Development Transmission Committee, that on a yearly basis, we've done that for the first 10 years, we've done that. So yeah, we can have that information.
Yeah, that legislation was put in place in 2009. It was effective starting in 2010.
Continue.
I sit on the Energy Development Committee, and I just thought it would be helpful for this committee to have that information too, since it seems to tie into some of the discussion. So if we can get it one way or the other, it'd be great. Thank you.
Absolutely. We'll send that report over.
We have seen a lot of overlap between the Energy Committee and the Tax Committee this interim, which I, of course, appreciate a great deal. So thank you for the information, Mr. Bame. Are there any other questions? Okay. Thank you. I lost sight of what we were looking at here myself. Okay, we were looking at the tax incentive memo that Emily expanded for us per request of one of the committee members from last meeting. Are there any other follow-up questions on that memo? Okay, well, not seeing any questions, I feel like this would be a good time for us to break. So let's take a break and come back at 10:15. And then we will hear from the tax department. All right, we'll bring the Taxation Committee back to order. We are ahead of schedule, which I'm excited about. I hope everybody else is too. We're on our 10:45 agenda item, which is comments from a representative of the tax department regarding the current 5- and 10-year oil extraction tax exemption for tertiary recovery projects as compared with other potential incentives discussed by the committee. I believe we have Mr. Kevin Schatz here with us this morning to help clarify some of the questions we've gotten this morning and give us some additional information. Good morning.
Good morning, Chairman Unruh, members of the committee. My name is Kevin Schatz with the Tax Commissioner's Office. I'm here to provide some information regarding tax reporting for general oil reporting and compared to enhanced recovery reporting, and to address some questions we have regarding the current bill before this committee. Generally, a purchaser is required to report and pay tax on a monthly basis. They base it on the sales of oil from a producer. The report that they submit includes both the gross production tax and the oil extraction tax. The report is based on API numbers, which allows us to determine which county that oil is produced in so that we can reconcile those amounts and certify those to the state treasurer every month for distribution of those taxes. With enhanced recovery, producer is required to report and pay the tax because their reporting is based on production and not sales. That production is based on a decline curve determination of primary and incremental production as determined by the North Dakota Industrial Commission, and they report and pay the taxes based on that. With the current bill before the committee, we had some questions that would probably need some clarification on. First of all, the bill would probably require some form changes in order to apply the credits, and also some resources to do some database changes in order to process those credits. And for clarification purposes, we were wondering how the producer would be able to take advantage of a credit in a situation where they were reporting on a stripper well that does not have any extraction tax due because of the oil extraction tax exemption on those wells. And the other question that came up was when a property is sold to another operator, who maintains the credits? Does it stay with the well and the new operator, or does that original operator that obtained the credits get to take it with them and take advantage of those in the future? So I'd be open to any questions the committee may have.
I don't see any specific questions, but I'm very thankful for your guys' review of the bill up in the tax department. I think we've come up with more questions than answers this morning, but we've seen that as a trend throughout this entire interim process, which I think is good. We're getting closer and closer to the goal, but I don't see any questions from committee members, so thank you very much.
I'll be available for the rest of the morning in case there is any.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Schatz. Okay, committee, we'll move on to our next agenda item, which is a presentation by Legislative Council staff on a memorandum summarizing various revenue streams that may be used to fund research relating to capture and use of carbon dioxide for enhanced oil recovery. Emily?
Thank you, Chairman Unruh. The memorandum, again, was requested to provide potential revenue streams that could be directed to research for CO2 capture and use in enhanced oil recovery. When I initially approached this research topic, I looked at the four main revenue sources. I looked at the oil extraction tax, the oil and gas gross production tax, the coal severance tax, and the coal conversion tax. And before I look further into the potential funds that could be used for oil and gas research for CO2 and oil extraction, or excuse me, enhanced recovery, I went ahead and just did a brief paragraph to kind of give an overview of which buckets the revenue from those sources are directed to. So the committee can be mindful that if revenue is increased to one fund, you know the other funds that might be being redirected from. So that's the first portion of the memorandum. You'll see the revenue from the oil extraction tax and the various funds that's directed to. And then I also included and the estimated distributions of each revenue type for the 2015-17 biennium. So that's where you'll see the dollar amounts there. You get an idea of the amount of money in essence that's going into those buckets for each revenue type. Same for the oil and gas gross production tax, the coal severance tax, and the coal conversion tax. The two potential areas that I focused on that could be possibly funded to a larger degree for purposes of research relating to CO2 capture and enhanced oil recovery were use of the Oil and Gas Research Fund and the Lignite Research Fund. Just briefly, the Oil and Gas Research Fund, it was established in 2003. It is currently funded by 2% of the state's share of oil and gas gross production tax and oil extraction tax revenues, and that's capped at up to $10 million per biennium. All money that's deposited into the fund is appropriate as a continuing appropriation to the Oil and Gas Research Council, and that is to be used for purposes specified in 5417.602, and one of those purposes, a few of those purposes, include promoting environmentally sound exploration and production methods and technologies, developing the state's oil and gas resources, and supporting research activities relating to oil and natural gas exploration and production. Potential option is to increase the revenues allocated to the Oil and Gas Research Fund to provide for additional funding related to that CO2 capture and enhanced oil recovery research. Another possibility is through the Lignite Research Fund. This fund is funded through an allocation of 70% of the taxes deposited in the Coal Development Trust Fund by a separate and additional coal severance tax, and that's a 2 cent per ton tax on coal or commercial leonardite that's severed for sale or industrial purposes. The Lignite Research Fund is also funded through an allocation of 5% of all coal conversion tax revenues allocated to the general fund. And that is only effective through July 31st, 2018. Monies deposited in the Lignite Research Fund may be used for specified purposes, which include provision of grants or loans for the purpose of conducting research related to lignite. A potential option here would be to increase the amount of coal severance tax revenues allocated to the Lignite Research Fund and potentially extend the coal conversion tax revenue allocated to the fund beyond the July 31st, 2018 date. And that's just a high-level overview, I guess, of some of the revenue sources are out there, where that revenue is currently going, and potential funds where some additional revenues could be directed. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Emily? I thought it was important for us to take a look not only at a lot of what we do in the taxation committee is taking a look at bringing the money in and which money doesn't have to come in, but I think it's also valuable for us to take a look at the back end where everything is distributed. I think there will be a need for us to make further investments in R&D as far as this goes. I think we've all learned that this interim. And these are some options here. I know there's some other creative options out there as well, some of which were talked about at the Empower Commission meeting yesterday. So I'd take any committee discussion on those thoughts. And I think before we move on to, we've got two reports that we have to receive here yet to complete our committee's work for this interim. But before we move on to receiving those reports, I think I'd like to wrap up the discussion on the bill draft that we have in front of us and any other initiatives or directives that committee members would like to see come out of this interim. Representative Steiner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Emily, on this estimated distribution of the oil and gas production tax revenue for 15-17 biennium, where did you get those numbers? Are they estimated from a previous budget? Are they estimated as of OMB's last? We just had a government finance meeting, and I'm just curious, are they the same numbers that we received in government finance?
Chairman Unruh, Representative Steiner, the numbers that I pulled for this memorandum actually is the latest update of a document that is continuously updated by the Legislative Council staff. It's you might be familiar with it, this flow chart here that shows all of the revenue distributions from all the different revenue sources and funds. Instead of just handing out this lovely chart, I thought it would be more convenient to break down the four main tax types that I included and all the funds that branch out from that. And so this document, as of October 2016, very recent, I don't know specifically the Government Finance Committee numbers that were provided. I would have to cross-check that. But this is estimated revenue sources and distributions for funds for the 2015-17 biennium, and that's as approved by the Legislative Assembly during the August 2016 special legislative session. So this is a quite recent update of that document, and that is available online, and I'd be happy to send it along to the committee members as well if you'd like a copy.
Well, I personally would love a copy of that. That's one of my favorite charts, so if you could pass that along to committee members, that'd be very beneficial. Thank you, Emily. Okay, committee members, we do have a bill draft in front of us. If we don't want to take action on that today, we don't have to. We can just let it sit. There doesn't need to be a motion, but I would like to put that conversation to rest before we move on to our other reports. Any thoughts? Okay, seeing no thoughts, we shall leave it there. And we can move on to our 11:15 agenda item, which is a presentation by a representative of the Tax Department of a report summarizing information contained in county reports regarding oil and gas gross production tax revenues received, expended, and unexpended. I see Mr. Morissette is here again. Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Joe Morissette from the Tax Department. And what I've distributed is a very summary document. As you may have noticed, linked to your agenda for this item are two large reports that compile all the information we've been asked to collect from the counties. I think one of them is nearly 600 pages, and one of them is almost 100 pages. And so those are linked to your agenda. They've been provided to Legislative Council. This is just an attempt to summarize those into somewhat of a usable fashion. We've been collecting this information since, I think, 2010 in some form or another. I believe the requirement to collect it from the counties started with, it's part of the gross production tax allocation section, and I think it started when language was added to that section regarding the infrastructure fund and the creation of that fund within the counties, and it was an attempt to collect information from the counties on how they're spending the gross production tax monies and how much is being allocated and where it's being allocated to. So as part of that section, counties provide us their financial statements, which show their revenues and expenditures for their various funds and their ending fund balances. So that's part of that's what makes the the final document that we provide to Legislative Council so large because it includes all those financial reports from all the counties. Of course, the problem in looking at that information is that all the counties maintain a slightly different fund structure. They don't all put the gross production tax in the same fund or account for it the same way. So we tried to simplify the reporting a little bit as much as we could for the counties and still meet the intent of the legislature in putting out this reporting requirement. So the second page of your handout, I should have put that first probably, but the second page is a sample of the form that we've provided to counties. We were able to fill in that first box because we know how much gross production tax was allocated to them by the state treasurer. So we fill that in and then we ask them, did you put this in your general fund? And if they did, then like box four just provides the math of what percentage that represents of their total general fund revenues. That's included on the first page in that summary document, just so you can see that as kind of a point of comparison, the relative importance to the different counties. And then we ask them the major uses of their county general fund, and if it's not one of those major categories that we kind of assumed it would be in most cases, then they can select other and they can provide us an example of how they used it. If they indicated that they didn't put it in their general fund, then they could provide an explanation. For this report, all counties indicated that they put it in their county general fund. That doesn't mean, of course, that they didn't transfer it out into like a road and bridge fund, because for some counties that's the process that they use. It goes in the general fund and it goes back out to another fund. But so we tried to simplify the reporting as much as we could and make find those common elements of how counties used it or allocated it and then summarize that for you. There's also a similar reporting requirement for school districts, and that was new in the 2015 session. So this was the first time we had to gather that information from the school district. So we worked with DPI because we know that there's already a lot of reporting requirements for the schools and the financial reports that they provide to DPI. So we did the same kind of a template. That's the last page in your handout, an example of the template that we provided to the schools. Again, we could populate the amount of gross production tax that they were allocated in that first box. We just asked them to indicate for us how they allocated it from there. They're also required to provide in statute to us as part of this report their financial statements and fund balances, but they already provide that to DPI. So we asked the school districts, do you want to send that to us now as part of this report, or do you want to have us just get the most current information from DPI when it's available? And it'll be available in October. I think by the end of October they have to provide it to DPI. So as part of this report, almost all school districts, except just a couple, said, yeah, please just go get it from DPI when we provide it there, so which is what we expected. And so as part of this report, we'll provide a supplement to Legislative Council with all of that financial information when it's available, and that way we weren't asking school districts to create the same thing in two different formats, send it to two different state agencies. We're able to just have them submit it once through the normal process, and we can get it from DPI and work with DPI on that and then provide it to Legislative Council. So it's all part of the same report. It's just that it'll kind of come in two pieces. They responded in the initial response as to how they allocated it in general terms, and then we'll get their financial information later and provide that. So, Madam Chairman, that is an overview of the information, and I'd be happy to try to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Morissette. Any questions? Senator Beckedahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Joe, on the first page, I don't see Ward County listed. Is there other oil producing counties that are not listed here? And if they're not here, why are they not on this sheet?
Madam Chairman, Senator Beckedahl, that's a good question. Ward did not respond to our request for information, and so we had a statutory deadline to submit the information to council, and so if it wasn't provided after a couple of attempts to reach out, we just provided council what we had. They did only receive about $22,000 in gross production tax, so out of that total of, unfortunately there's no total, but the total that of those numbers in that first column is about $133 million, so out of that total they received such an immaterial amount that we just sent the report on and didn't include them at all.
Senator
and there
Cook.
Are a few school districts, to follow up on your question, Senator Beckedahl, there's a few school districts on those pages, which would be the the not the last one, but the two pages right before that, there's about seven or eight school districts, typically the very small ones, that did not respond to the survey. If we will still include their overall financial information that we'll get from DPI, because we can pull that for all school districts, but their response to this form that we sent them, there was no response in the case of a few school districts.
Mr. Morissette, are there any repercussions for them not returning the form, withholding any of their next checks or anything like that?
Madam Chairman, there is not, because from our end, it's only a reporting requirement that we have to collect this information from them, but there's really no teeth in it.
So. Okay, thank you. Senator Cook?
I'm just curious, Madam Chairman, Joel, what amount has to be, what amount is significant enough where you would take some action against them? Or nothing. Assume that there's no amount where you would do anything because you don't have any teeth.
Madam Chairman, Senator Cook, that's the case. There's nothing spelled out in law that would allow us to take any steps against a county or school district that doesn't comply with that, and we don't do the allocation. That's done separately through the treasurer's office. So really, we're just the collector of the information, kind of on the back end.
Continue.
Madam Chairman, I just find this to be unacceptable. And it's not only in this report, I've been spending some time with local officials trying to identify all the challenges in meeting all the steps that have to be met between for property tax purposes, as far as from the assessment date in February till the final budget is approved. And in order for this to work smoothly, everybody's got to do their job and do it on time. And the number of people that are involved in this that just seem not to care about meeting a deadline, it just blows my mind. I don't know if it's incompetence, lack of people, or whatever it is, but we're looking at a bill draft that'll put some penalties for not meeting your deadline in time. And as far as I'm concerned, we should do the same thing here. If they don't meet the reporting requirements, they don't need to get a check the next year. That should get their attention, but we can't just sit here and do nothing. There's a reason why these reports are necessary. If they're not necessary, let's eliminate them. But if we need this information, we got to take it serious, and everybody's got to understand it serious.
I fully support that concept, Senator Cook. I think it's unacceptable to just simply not respond for a request for information. Senator Triplett.
Madam Chairman and Mr. Morissette, this is a kinder and gentler response, but not that I disagree with Senator Cook necessarily, but rather than just leaving them off the report, it seems to me maybe you could file an amended report in your summary that just includes Ward County and says no response received from the county, and the sort of public embarrassment might encourage them to get their information in, as opposed to making us sort of go, oh, somebody's missing from this list, as Senator Becquedal noted. Just a thought.
Madam Chairman, we could certainly modify our summary report very easily and send that to Emily so it's be part of the committee record if you'd like.
I would appreciate that, we'll Mr. Morissette. Great suggestion, Senator Triplett. Okay, I don't see any other comments or questions, so thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you.
Okay, we're moving right along this morning. Our next presentation will be by Ms. Carla Hahn, Accountability Manager with the Department of Commerce, on an annual grant or report relating to the Business Incentive Accountability Law. I believe we received 1 year's worth of report in a previous committee meeting, and now we will be receiving the latest and greatest. Good morning.
Good morning. Chairman Unruh and members of the Taxation Committee, my name is Carla Hahn. I'm the Accountability Manager for the North Dakota Department of Commerce, and I'm here today to provide the annual report for calendar year 2015 on a business incentive accountability law as directed by North Dakota Century Code. The information provided is as of December 31st, 2015. The business incentive accountability law was approved during the 2005 session and took effect January 1st, 2006. The law applies to businesses that receive incentives totaling $25,000 or more in a given year from state or local grantors. The law requires grantors and recipient businesses enter into an agreement before that business receives its incentive. The agreement contains a description of the incentive to be granted as well as job goals that the business is to achieve within 2 years. Recipient businesses must report on their progress toward these goals for at least 2 years and until they meet their goal. Another requirement of the BIA agreement is it must meet a public purpose, for example, assisting community development, increasing the tax base, directly creating employment opportunities, or indirectly creating employment opportunities through increased economic activities. So the programs that are granting these incentives are the APUC program, the CDBG program, and it would be the economic development projects under the CDBG program, entrepreneurship grants, income tax exemption for new or expanding businesses granted through the State Board of Equalization, the PACE programs offered through the Bank of North Dakota, the North Dakota Development Fund, the Renaissance Zone, and tourism grants. For the period 2011 through 2015, there were 748 agreements entered into the database with a total incentive value of just over $107 million. If you look on table one, it's on page four. We provide the breakdown incentives by the type of incentives. And then a little bit farther down on that page on table two, we provide the same breakdown by public purpose. On page five, table three, we provide it broken down by business type, and we use the North American Industrial Classification System, or the NAICS code, to provide that breakdown. And then on table four, on page nine, that provides the number of agreements in the database by year and the goal type, so whether their goal was to create jobs, retain jobs, or neither. Then tables 5A, 5B, and 5C, beginning on page 9, show that there were 2,650 jobs created or retained over the last 5 years, compared to a goal of 2,583 jobs. Also included in those jobs, there was just under 1,300 jobs are considered bonus jobs. And a bonus job is when a public purpose does not require job creation. Such as assisting community development. And so projects with no job creation goals are still required to report to us annually. And if they do report that they've created jobs, we record those as a bonus job.
Ms. Hunt, if I could interrupt for a question, and this might be a very silly question. If their goal isn't to create or retain jobs, what might their goals be?
So at that point, they are not required to create jobs. They're under the Business Incentive Accountability Law. They just need to report a period of two years.
Okay.
Also on tables 5A, 5B, and 5C, the wages and benefits are provided as compared to the goals. And as you can see, they generally exceed the goals in almost all of the years for that. Finally, on chart one, which is on page 10, it shows the timeline when the business incentives reach their goals. The majority of the goals are reached within 2 years, that's 73%. 16% met their goals in 3 years, and 11% took the 4 years. A full copy of this report, including the 192-page compilation of results by business, is available on Commerce's website. And Commerce also has a public search feature on our website that's available for all to use, and it gives real-time results of the business incentive agreements. Chairman Unruh and members of the Taxation Committee, this concludes my report, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any questions from the committee? I'll give you just a second to digest, maybe. Senator Cook?
Well, Madam Chairman, my first thought is there's another tax committee that meets during this interim, and I think this report would be more suitable for that committee. But I'm trying to digest this a little bit. I'm looking at table three. And I'd just like to have you explain this to me. Incentive value by type of business. And we see the business type, the first one there is real estate. What type of incentive would we be offering real estate? Can you just explain that a little bit? It'd be nice if, don't answer that. It would be nice if we would see the incentives also that are used there, but I mean, real estate, would it be APUC?
Chairman Unruh, Senator Cook, my thought on real estate, it would be primarily the PACE program. In fact, Flex PACE offered to the Bank of North Dakota.
Okay.
I understand they have that multi-housing.
Okay. So Flex PACE would probably be the one that was used to create real estate.
Yep. And if you
most
would go...
Most of it would be housing then.
Yes, that would be my thought.
Okay.
And on the public search feature on our website, one of the options that you can search under would be by a three-digit NAICS code. So if you were interested, you could certainly go out there and see as well.
Representative Steiner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you know how much cash has been granted to individuals through this program? Direct cash to an individual North Dakotan? Not a business, well, it's a business, but it's a direct cash grant.
It is broken down by, let me find it here. So on table one, so direct cash transfer loan or equity of investment, that would be a direct cash grant or a loan. So that would provide the breakdown there.
Senator Cook.
We have a community that is providing incentives to restaurants by giving them half of the sales tax they collected back to them. Would that program, a local program created by a local government, fall subject to this report?
Political subdivisions do fall under the Business Incentive mm-hmm. Accountability Law, and they are required to comply with the law. In that particular instance, I guess I'm unsure because the law does exclude any incentives that are granted that are available to all groups. So if you apply for a tax incentive on your tax forms, that's available generally available to everyone. This law specifically applies to those that are granted by some entity.
Continue.
Restaurants would, if it's available to all restaurants, that's considered tax policy and not an incentive because it's not involved with other businesses.
Chairman Unruh, Senator Cook, I would interpret it that way.
Well, we do have the chairman of the other tax committee here, and I'm glad that he's received this report as well. I do think it falls much more in the purview of what the Political Subdivisions Taxation Committee is looking at this interim, but I would imagine it was required to go through here. I appreciate the information, and we can certainly talk with the chairman about maybe reviewing this tomorrow as well. So. Any other questions from the committee members? Okay, I don't see any. Thank you very much for your time. Okay, committee, well, that completes all of our official duties for this interim. And I think we'll fully wrap up our interim work. I will leave the floor open here for any committee discussion that you feel is necessary, or any other thoughts as we head into the next legislative session? Senator Beckedahl.
I know I'm the rookie here, but I'd like to offer my thanks to both you and Emily and other staff that have provided all the input to the committee. I think you did a wonderful job, so thank you for your service as chair.
Thank you, Senator Beckedahl. I was wondering if that was maybe a motion for the chairman and legislative council staff to prepare a report and present the report to legislative management.
So moved.
Thank you. Is there a second? Okay, it's been moved and seconded that we have legislative council staff prepare a report and present that report to legislative management. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign. Motion carries. The last piece of business that we have to do is sine die. Senator Cook?
I move we adjourn sine die.
It's been moved and seconded that we adjourn sine die for the taxation committee this interim. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign. Motion carries. Thank you very much for your hard work, this interim committee. I think we did some good things.